in terms of where we are, I think we're at a very important point for individuals thinking about prevention. We went through a period where a lot of the preventive actions were being mandated, you know, by government, particularly in Kentucky. So there were, you know, closures of non-essential businesses, schools closed, you know, the same thing was true in many other places around the country. Now, as various states go through reopening plans, you know, the pandemic hasn't gone away, but we are transitioning to a point where prevention is really going to require individuals choosing to take different kinds of preventive actions, wearing masks, social distancing, staying home if they think that there's a chance of exposure, being tested so that they know for sure, you know, if there's a chance of exposure, and so on. And that really makes the decision-making more complicated for individual people. But it makes it even more critically important, I think, for everybody to take those preventive measures.
Yeah, and that opens up, I started to say a can of worms, but it opens up the issue of personal choice, I guess, and how far do I want it, how do I want to react to this disease? And there are varying opinions, as we all know, right?
Right. Yeah, and I'm going to pull that question apart into three different aspects, because I think they're all very important to acknowledge. The first is that, you know, a lot of the things that people are being asked to do in terms of preventive measures now are things that are not easy and not always pleasant, you know, from an individual perspective. You know, staying home with my children for the past 3 months without them leaving the house, you know, has been unpleasant at times. The remote work agreements are not as enjoyable as, you know, being in person with the people that I like interacting with every day, not seeing relatives. You know, all of these things have personal costs, and we know also that they have societal costs in terms of economics. So I think one dimension, you know, of that complexity and that can of worms is that health, you know, both public and individual, is one part of the decision-making process. But I think that we do have to acknowledge that there are multiple factors and multiple pieces to the puzzle, you know, that have to be weighed. That said, you know, the second piece, when you start to think about the health aspect, is that, you know, COVID-19 and infectious diseases are a little bit different than a lot of the ways that we often make, you know, health decisions, that we tend to think very individually, you know, when we're making decisions about our health. And of course, you know, in the can of worms and the multiple degrees of freedom, you know, the United States has a strong value on individual liberty and individual decision making. In the case of an infectious disease pandemic, though, you know, the risk to the community is also critically important in how people make decisions and when, you know, these kinds of preventive measures need to be put in place. That, you know, you're not only social distancing, wearing masks, you know, working remotely for your own individual risk, you're also doing it to prevent transmission to other individuals and to keep the community as a whole safe. And that's something that we are, as just kind of individuals making decisions about our lives and deciding what to do, we're not particularly good at thinking about it. And it's a challenging thing cognitively to think about it. And it's also not the way that we usually frame our world and frame our decisions. You know, we're much better at thinking about what I do and what I get from it than we are thinking about a more abstract community population level good, you know, or population level risk. So then the last piece, you know, of kind of pulling apart that question is, you know, the question of should there be, you know, mandates to do behaviors or not do certain behaviors, you know, when should government, you know, put in place restrictions? You know, the should part of that and what is from a values-based perspective right or wrong, or what's politically right or wrong, is outside of my wheelhouse. From a public health perspective, though, you know, we tend to think about those kinds of mandates and encouraging them in situations where we're asking people to do things or needing them to do things that don't necessarily benefit them individually, but really do have a benefit for society as a whole. And of course, many of the COVID-19 restrictions, you know, fall under that guideline. We also tend to think about those kinds of mandates when there are things that really must be done by a large portion of the population to be effective. And we also tend to think about the mandates when the behaviors are more complicated and harder to do. And so where there may be resistance to doing them from just a kind of an individual, you know, willingness or good perspective. I think there's a useful analogy to many traffic laws. You know, for example, if I think only about my own individual good and don't think about anybody else, you know, the best thing for me is to get to work as quickly as I possibly can and to do it in the way that maximizes my driving and my efficiency. If I do that and everybody else does that, none of us ever get to work because we all crash. And so we have to put in place restrictions because sort of the individual person risk is relatively large. But if nobody's following the traffic rules, the collective risk is really high. There's a good analogy, I think, to that and some of the things that we're doing in the space of COVID-19. And so, again, the, you know, what is right or wrong and what should be done from a government level is really beyond my expertise. But thinking just about public health and how we maximize the preventive behaviors, we are in a situation where, you know, mandates are an effective way of encouraging people to do behaviors that reduce transmission of COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of behaviors, I don't think there's any question about it that wearing a mask, when to wear a mask, how to wear a mask is another debated item and a lot of varying opinions. I guess I'll ask, are you surprised that that is such a debated item?
I'd say yes and no. So on the one hand, you know, I think the majority of Americans at this point recognize that COVID-19 is a serious issue, right? And recognize that it is a pandemic. That it is affecting a lot of people, there are deaths from it. And so in that sense, you know, I do think that not everybody recognizes that importance, but there's general recognition. This is a big deal. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, you know, people recognizing the severity and the spread of things should make them more likely to do these kinds of, you know, very simple actions like wearing a mask. So in that sense, yes, it is surprising that it's a very low cost, easy to do behavior that is related to, you know, to reducing transmission. On the other hand, you know, our persistent experience in public health is that people's engagement in preventive behaviors is lower than we would like it to be from a health perspective and lower than you might expect. So, you know, we're still learning about what people are doing in the age of COVID-19, because again, it is a very, in the grand scheme of public health science, it's a new thing. But we do know from previous pandemics that engaging in preventive behaviors is lower than you might expect. So for example, the swine flu outbreak in 2009, our research group did some work looking at people's willingness to do different preventive behaviors and how much they actually did. And we found that most people said, yeah, of course, you know, I would be willing to do these things to help prevent disease transmission. But then when you asked, are you actually washing your hands? Are you staying home, you know, when you feel ill? You know, in many cases, 50-60% was the highest number of people who said that they were doing those things. So this is part of kind of a longer history, you know, in public health of doing of not seeing the rates of preventive behaviors that we would like. I think it's also, you know, the case, again, you mentioned earlier that a lot of COVID-19 questions open cans of worms. I think this is another one that we've also layered on, that masks have become something of a political issue, and that, you know, there certainly is a portion of the population that feels like they are making important statements about their values, either by wearing a mask, you know, to demonstrate one set of values and affiliations, or by, you know, making a conscious decision not to wear a mask, you know, on the other side. And that's, you know, another layer that I think complicates, you know, engaging in the behavior. But the bottom line, I think, from public health is that of the sets of things, you know, that people are being asked to do that we know has a demonstrable effect on reducing transmission of the COVID-19 virus, mask wearing is probably the best combination of easy to do and effective to reduce transmission. there are things that are more effective, but they're much harder to do. And mask wearing is really, from a public health perspective, a no-brainer. It's something that just absolutely should be done.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one of the things that we're also seeing, and this is not brand new, but it's being a lot more attention is being given to it, is the increasing number of cases with young people. And they, I think this morning I heard a news story that was like 18 to 34. And I guess the question there is, is there going to be the possibility to convince people of that age to wear a mask more often?
Right. Well, that's a big question. And obviously, you know, as a faculty member at the University of Kentucky, something that we're grappling with right now, right, as we think about how to reopen. I think the things that we think about in terms of people's willingness to do preventive behaviors is convincing them that, you know, the health problem is serious and that it could affect them. Because both of those things make a difference. We know that when people think something is serious and think that they're susceptible, they're more likely to do it. We also know that making it easy to engage in the behavior makes a difference, right? So if we can make it convenient to wear masks, we can provide them, if we can set norms around doing it. And then, you know, the last piece is really the social acceptability of doing so. That, and I think this goes back to what we were talking about a minute ago about the sort of political dimensions of mask wearing, that the broader social acceptability of doing something becomes quite important. And so, you know, convincing 18 to 34-year-olds to wear masks and to do other preventative behaviors, I think, really requires each of those things, you know, to happen.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, Mark, I did also want to ask about, and kind of going back to what we talked about earlier, but if you have that personal experience where you have a family member or a close friend that has, you know, had or, you know, experienced this disease, that's got to make a difference too, right? If you don't have that personal knowledge,
yes,
you don't take as much what's stake in the whole issue.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, the personal connection, having a family history or a friend history, knowing those things really does make a difference. And I think that, you know, there are two elements to that. I mean, one is that personal contact and watching somebody, you know, address the disease is a very real and concrete way to get a sense of severity. And, you know, one of the things that we know about COVID-19 is that, you know, a lot of the sort of rhetoric about, well, it's just like a cold or just like the flu is not the case. I mean, even the relatively straightforward cases that resolve are typically, you know, a multi-week kind of active period. And then in many cases, symptoms are lingering, you know, for weeks or months afterwards. We also know that, you know, a portion of the people who get the illness become very, very ill. And, you know, regardless of the sort of level of illness experience that somebody you personally know has had, it gives that very concrete sense of both severity and sense of vulnerability. That's hard to come by, you know, otherwise. It's harder to think about statistics about number of cases. It's much easier to think about the person, you know, you know, as you said, down the street, or, you know, a friend of a friend or a family member who has had the illness. You know, one useful thought experiment, I think, for people who are on the fence about whether or not to do preventive behaviors or whether social distancing is worth it, is to sort of engage in the thought experiment of, you know, how would I feel if a family member or someone close to me, you know, contacted COVID-19 because I didn't engage, you know, in preventive behaviors. And yeah, I mean, that sort of hypothetical can be a way of trying to have the experience, you know, I guess, if you haven't had personal contact, you know, with the illness. You know, one thing I do want to mention, because you were speaking at the beginning about, you know, the experience of COVID-19 in Appalachia. And, you know, I think one of the things that is happening as we continue, you know, through the kind of national experience of the epidemic is that different localities in the U.S. are starting to experience COVID-19, and especially starting to see a number of cases, you know, at very different rates. That, you know, our major urban areas, because of the density of people and because of the amount of travel in and out, you had a lot of cases early on and really dealt with the bulk of the pandemic. And then, you know, I think what we're seeing now is more of a diffusion into, you know, the rest of the country, including, you know, our communities in Appalachia. And I think that's going to change, you know, the dynamic for folks in those communities. You know, you're starting to see cases in a number of counties in eastern Kentucky. You're seeing some deaths in eastern Kentucky now that were not happening as much earlier in the pandemic, when, you know, the spread was really much more in urban areas. And, you know, as we think about, you know, people's attitudes and kind of ongoing engagement in preventive behaviors, we do have a lot of areas now, including eastern Kentucky, where folks have been asked to engage in staying at home and other preventive measures at a time when the pandemic was more in other parts of the state than it was in their localities. And now, you know, the pandemic is spreading to those localities, and that's going to make those preventive behaviors even more important. Even though we've been doing them for a while and we're getting tired of staying home and doing those things, you know, as you start to see spread in a community, that's really when all of those preventive measures become critically important to keep it from skyrocketing, you know, in the ways that it has in many other areas.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mark, I guess one final question. And it's very hard, obviously, to predict where this disease is going. But I think it is, suffice it to say, it's still going to be with us for some time, even when a vaccine comes along. But yeah. But how do you I guess, a little bit of speculation, but in terms of public attitude about this, say, 3-4 months from now, do you think it will change greatly?
Yeah. So... do I think it will change greatly? Yes. Can I follow that up with telling you exactly how it will change? No. I think that, you know, one of the things that is, you know, true of COVID-19 is that things are changing and progressing so rapidly that, you know, people's individual experiences as well as our collective community experiences are different, you know, week to week. And those things really do shape people's attitudes and beliefs. You know, it's different than something like, you know, let's say eating fruits and vegetables for your risk for heart disease, where message has been pretty stable, experience in life has been pretty stable. You know, it's not as though things are happening every week that changes your information and changes your attitude. COVID-19 is different in that way, just because it is new and the dynamics are still changing. So, you know, we know, for example, that early on in the pandemic, if you asked residents of New York and Los Angeles how supportive they were of stay-at-home orders and social distancing, there was actually really good public support for those measures, because people saw, right, you know, the active impact of the disease in those communities when those measures were in place. We know that in other places of the country, those attitudes were not as individually positive. So, you know, how you feel and how you think about it really depends on the experience that you're having and that those close to you and those in your community are having. You know, I think it's safe to say that the shape of the pandemic will change over time, whether that is continuing to see an increase in cases like we're seeing in many areas of the country right now, or seeing the number of cases go down. Really does depend on the measures that we take. So yes, attitudes will change. Yes, behaviors will change. But what happens next really depends a lot about what we all do, you know, individually and collectively to try to prevent disease spread.